Tennessee before. Mr. Mercy will present argument for the business.
And please the court. Counsel. I'm John Mercy. I practice law in Texarkana. I'm here today on behalf of petitioners of Mount Pleasant Independent School District and John Gilliam. This case presents an interesting situation to the court. The Court of Appeals has sought in this case to impose a new standard of care where none has existed before, in a situation in which if you apply it, the facts don't even warrant. To get to that conclusion, I think it's necessary for this court to be aware of the factual basis of this lawsuit. There are some facts that I think have been confused by the abstractor who...
You were here last...
Yes, Your Honor. Deja vu. But it's a different question this time.
I understand.
I didn't think the facts were confused last week.
No, Your Honor. They were crystal clear, unfortunately.
Isn't there just really, if you prevail on the issue that the school bus was not involved, isn't that the whole ball game, right?
Yes, Your Honor. There's basically a three-step analysis to this case that I'll get into in a second. It appears from the abstract of the Supreme Court Journal that there's some confusion about the facts. In particular, the statements made in there regarding the bus, says normally the bus would stop directly across the highway from the entrance to the trailer park where the child lived, and she would cross while the bus and other traffic waited. However, on this day, the bus stopped 40 yards short of the point, so the child got off and then had to walk the remaining 40 yards and attempt to cross the highway after the bus left. That's just wrong. I don't know where it got picked up from. The facts are this, that she lived at a trailer park on Highway 271 north of Mount Pleasant. There are two bus stops or two entrances to that trailer park. Her normal stop where she would get off typically was the first stop. There's no dispute on the day in question that Mr. Gilliam stopped the bus at that bus stop. Seven or eight children got off, crossed the street, went to the trailer park. The child in question here did not. He went to the second bus stop, which was a normal bus stop at that trailer park. She got off at the second bus stop. Whatever her reasoning was for not getting off at her bus stop, we don't know. There was evidence that on occasion she would go to the second bus stop, go to the second bus stop, get off, and go to the babysitter's house. But on the occasion in question, we don't know. In any event, when she exited the bus at the second bus stop, she got off, she walked, if you will, picture the bus is stopped going north, so it's in the eastbound lane. The trailer park is on the west side. The bus stopped, turned on its red lights, traffic stopped. In fact, there were cars behind the bus that stopped. She gets off the bus and heads to the east in the direction of a house that's there where the other child that got off was headed. She walked approximately 6 to 8 steps that way and then started sort of wandering back down through the ditch area there, stopped to tie her shoe, and by this time the bus had pulled off. There's no dispute that from the witnesses that saw the accident, there was no indication whatsoever that she intended to cross the road at that time. She didn't attempt to walk in front of the bus. She starts walking back down the road. In fact, one of the ladies in a car behind the bus waved her across, and she shook her head and continued to walk down the road. We don't have any idea what she was doing. It's that simple.
Is it a two-lane or four-lane?
It's a two-lane highway at this point.
Is there any requirement on the bus driver that they wait there until children cross the road? Any regulations?
I'm not sure there's specific regulations, and there may be, but it's their custom when there are children crossing the street. They pull up, open the door, which activates the red lights, and maintain that position until the children have crossed the street. Now, there may be a regulation to that effect, Your Honor. I didn't try the case.
But it's not a regulation, a custom.
Custom, yes, Your Honor. And in fact, that was what was done on this day at the first bus stop when there were children crossing the street. The evidence of the case was at the first bus stop, he stops, puts on his red lights. After they've crossed, he turns on his yellow lights and proceeds the 40 yards to the second stop where he once again stops the traffic with his red lights. The evidence in the case is undisputed that after the child indicated there was no evidence of her going across the street and started going back down the east side of the road, the bus pulled off. The bus was approximately a quarter of a mile away at the time that the child decided to dart across the street and was hit by the pickup truck. She had waited for the three cars that were stopped behind the bus to proceed. The evidence was that they were approximately 150, 200 yards down the road already when she decided to cross the road. And for whatever reason, she was struck by a pickup truck coming from the north in a southbound direction, and she was killed. There are three things that we have to look at in this case. First of all is the fact that the question of whether this was use and operation of a motor vehicle as contemplated under the Tort Claims Act. The plaintiffs brought their cause of action under the Tort Claims Act, and therefore the only liability that can be imposed upon the school district, as this court has held and as the statutes say, is in use and operation of motor vehicle. The evidence is just not in the record that this accident, that the injuries were approximately caused by the use and operation of this motor vehicle. It defies reality to think that when the bus is a quarter of a mile away, that it is a causational factor in the accident, especially in light of the intervening facts of her being attempted to wave across the street by the car behind the bus and turning down that invitation and waiting until, in fact, those cars had pulled off. The bus driver in this case, as the court's aware, is entitled to share that immunity under the Education Code. That was decided by this case in the court in the Hopkins case, and I don't think we have the situation that warranted the dissent by Judge Kilgarland in that case, because there's no question in this case of an interpretation of that particular statute.
Excuse me for not knowing this fact, and you may have already said it, but was it her normal procedure to cross? She was generally on the other side of the street, or was it her normal? When they let her off, she stayed on this side.
When she stopped,
getting off at the second stop.
There's no evidence of that in the record, Your Honor. Her normal procedure at the first stop would be to cross the street. The evidence in this case was that the bus driver did not know where she lived. He was familiar with her by sight, didn't know her name, didn't know in particular where she lived. There's a chance in this case that, and this isn't in the record, that she could have been going to the young man's house that she got off with, because she was basically in front of his house when she decided to cross the street. There's no evidence, and we can't define what her intentions were that day. So we're in that kind of a situation. When you give the meaning that this court has ascribed to use and operation of a motor vehicle, you give it the plain meaning of those terms. And there is no evidence in this case of use or operation which would have been a causational factor in this situation, especially in light of the fact that this is no different from a situation that was, or it's analogous to a situation in the Higher versus Northeast Independent School District, where in fact they were waiting for a bus when they were struck by a motorist. They were not on the bus. The court in that case said that that's not use and operation of a motor vehicle. There have been several cases before this court on variations on the theme. There's the Garza case, which was a stabbing on the bus, which the court has held was not use and operation. Then there's the Hopkins case, where the child was in need of medical attention because of convulsions. And the court said that the mere presence of the bus does not constitute use and operations. There has to be a causative factor in between. Despite this, despite the lack of evidence of any use, and that was submitted to the jury. If you'll look at the issues that were submitted, the question was John Gilligan negligent in the use of the bus on the date in question, or words to that effect. So that was submitted to the jury, and they found that he was not. In spite of this, the Court of Appeals in Texarkana has decided that this is a situation that warrants the imposition of liability on the school district, even though it falls outside the legislature's clear intent in drafting the Tort Claims Act. Initially, there's a dichotomy here. The plaintiffs in their pleadings said that because the school district was a common carrier, there should be a high degree of care. The Court of Appeals found that they were not a common carrier. But then the Court of Appeals goes on and says, well, even though they're not, we think the rationale will hold. Well, there's no question that the school district is not a common carrier. There is also no case law in Texas and very little in the country that would impose liability in this situation. In fact, the majority of jurisdictions who've addressed this have applied an ordinary degree of care. The cases cited by the Court of Appeals are distinguishable from the fact situation here. They were cases, and they're cited in their brief, and we distinguished them in ours, where those cases, the school district had contracted with private individuals to provide transportation. That's not the case here. John Gillian had been a bus driver for 15 years. The school district owned the bus, and it was their normal course to transport students, as they would do. The court also includes in this new higher standard of care the duty to anticipate the conduct and prevent harm to a child. There is no legislative authority for that. There is no case law for that. That is a totally new duty imposed upon school districts by the Texarkana Court. That hasn't even been imposed by the other jurisdictions that they cite to. The majority rule is ordinary care when you're transporting students. That has a good sound basis when applied to school districts because they're not for hire, they're not open to the public, and it's a governmental function whereby they have voluntarily taken on the transportation of students to and from school. They don't have to do it. There's no requirement that they bus students. In fact, I'll get to the effect of this case, the potential effect of this case in a moment. The other thing...
Doesn't the education code require the district to provide transportation when it's more than 2 miles from the student's home to...
There are situations where it's required, you're right. But there are also situations where it's provided that they're, and it's not required. I'll address that in a moment when we get to the public policy arguments with regard to this case. The other thing is that the courts in Texas, the closest they've come to addressing this type of an issue are in cases involving transportation of prisoners or in transportation of injured persons, and a couple of cases cited in the brief. In those cases, they say that the duty is ordinary care. And the reasoning is exactly the opposite of the Court of Appeals in Texarkana. The Court of Appeals in Texarkana said we should impose this duty because the inequality in position because a student can't protect themselves. Well, the prisoners are in the same situation. The injured parties that are being transported are in the same situation. So that is not a consideration in determining the degree of care to be used.
Well, I'm reading the CA opinion here. A child riding a school bus should be entitled to the same degree of care as that exercised for the benefit of the passenger on a common carrier. Do you take issue with that?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that is in the face of the majority opinion in the other jurisdictions. There's no basis for that in Texas law. In fact, the only opinion that seems to touch on that is the dissenting opinion in the Garza case, where they talk about the duty of ordinary care. Otherwise, it's a case of first impression on that point, but there is no basis otherwise for an imposition of that particular standard. But let's assume for a second, even though there's no basis in law for the standard, let's apply it to this case. And Judge Kilgarlin just quoted the part I was going to read to the court. It says, a child riding in a school bus should be entitled to the same degree of care as that exercised for the benefit of a passenger on a common carrier. There's no evidence in this case that the duty of care was breached while she was on the bus, while she was riding. She was not a passenger under any definition that has been given to common carrier cases or in Texas law. In fact, in common carrier cases, once the person safely alights from the vehicle, the duty ends. So what the Texarkana Court has sought to do is impose a much more strict obligation on the school district than they've even done in common carrier cases. The evidence is not in dispute. In fact, there's a request for admission from the school district that we admitted where she had alighted. The plaintiffs have pled it that way. It was tried that way. The court submitted it that way. The Court of Appeals looked at it that way. There's no question she was off the bus. The duty that arises once you're off the bus is ordinary care. So even assuming that this high degree of care that the court has come up with applies, it doesn't apply to this case because she was not a passenger. Now, if you look at it in that light, the court has reversed it because of an improper instruction by the district court. I contend and submit to this court that the instruction was proper. He instructed the jury on ordinary care, which under the facts of this case, with the decedent having gotten off the bus, is the proper instruction. And even under the opinion of the Court of Appeals in Texarkana, it's still the proper instruction. There's no reason to send this case back. The court in Texarkana should have, under this court's ruling in the Poole v. Ford case, looked at the evidence and decided if the standard applied. They did not. So I think under the evidence that even their standard, which I still contend shouldn't have been applied, doesn't fit the facts of this case. And therefore, this court should affirm the trial court's finding, reverse the Court of Appeals, because there's no basis for their opinion.
Yeah, how far away was the bus when she crossed the road? The bus had let her out and had gone on, and then she, crossed behind the bus?
Judge Ray, the situation was this. She started back down the east side. The bus pulled off and was approximately a quarter of a mile away. As the bus was pulling off, there were three cars behind the bus, and all three of the drivers testified. The lady behind the bus attempted to wave her across, and she shook her head and continued to walk down the side of the road, or down the ditch. It was only after those three cars had pulled off and were approximately 150 to 200 yards away that she decided to cross the road. By estimation, the bus was approximately a quarter of a mile away.
So your contention is that the bus driver had absolutely nothing to do with her injury.
Correct.
He had done all he was supposed to do and had left the scene, really.
Yes, sir.
And the motor vehicle made a decision.
But this does not arise from the use or operation of motor vehicle, which is the only way to impose liability. The troubling thing to this case is the public policy considerations for imposition of this type of a standard on school districts. If you put aside the fact that the legislature hasn't waived the immunity in this particular situation, but if you look at the public policy considerations, there are over 1,000 school districts in this state. Every one of those in one form or another provides transportation to their students. This will put them in the position of being exposed to litigation in that transportation that was unanticipated and wasn't reflected in the legislature's intent. It will also increase their costs. And when I was here last week, there was a case in front of the court with regard to problems that the school districts are having. And it's well known right now that school districts are having trouble meeting their budgets. It'll increase their costs because with the imposition of this type of standard, they'll have to have more vehicles, they'll have to have more personnel, because effectively this standard will require them to stay parked until they're positive that the person is intended to cross the street. In fact, a logical extension is until they're sure that the person is home. It'll ensure door-to-door service. The cost would go up for personnel, for equipment, training, as well as most school districts are insured by liability insurers, and it will drive the cost of liability insurance for school buses up. So those public policy considerations, I think, are important, plus the fact that imposition of liability in this case will also mean, by analogy, that liability should be imposed upon police departments in transportation of prisoners, which this court has never done, by analogy to transportation by government-owned ambulance, of a high degree of care, which this court has never done. And there are other situations and other governmental entities that would be affected by a decision of this type imposing that type of a test.
Is there anything in the record about custom that school bus drivers let their children off on the side of the road next to the house so that they don't have to cross the road?
I think that question was kind of asked, but your specific question was the custom to let them off on the side of the road where they live. There's nothing in the record to that effect. In this situation, at the first bus stop, he had stopped and children had crossed the road while he stopped traffic with his blinkers. So I guess by analogy, there's nothing in the record addressing your specific question.
This was not her question, but she got on your son.
And we don't know why. We can't read the little girl's mind. The court, in analyzing this case, I think needs a three-step approach. One, whether there's even any liability that's imposable under the Tort Claims Act. I contend that there isn't, because it's not use and operation of motor vehicle. Second is, I guess it's a four-step procedure. The second question then is, if there is liability, is the school district a common carrier? And I think that issue's been foreclosed. And that's what the plaintiffs had pled. Getting past that, you're to the question of whether or not there's a high degree of care. The plaintiffs, in their pleadings, never raised another vehicle by which to bring that to the court. They never pled anything other than the fact the school district was a common carrier. So I'm not sure that they have properly preserved that. But even assuming all three of those, the facts in this case do not apply to the standard the court below has imposed. It's basically that simple. They have come up with a standard that just doesn't fit the facts in this case.
And then the final step is whether or not there should be a new duty.
I'm sorry?
The final step would be whether or not Texas County Court acted correctly in fashioning a new duty.
Yes. And if they did, the question is whether Poole applies and they should have looked at the evidence. I don't think the court will need to get to that point, but if they do, they've got to look at this case in light of the Poole decision and the court's failure to address those issues.
Maybe I misread this. I don't understand that the Texas County Court reversed because they felt that the evidence, the jury answer was against the great weight of the preponderance, but they reversed because the wrong issue was submitted to the jury.
Yes, Your Honor. But on motion for rehearing, it was argued to them that there was no evidence to support this. I mean, that the evidence was that there was no negligence by John Gilley in support.
Isn't that the same thing, though, that no negligence in the sense of ordinary care as opposed to high degree of care?
I'm not sure I follow your question.
Well, you say on motion for rehearing that they held against the no evidence assertion. Was that a no evidence assertion on ordinary care negligence, or was that a no evidence assertion on high degree of care negligence?
It was an assertion that either standard didn't apply. There was no evidence to support a finding under either standard. And the record is totally devoid, even with the higher standard, of any evidence of negligence. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We're now ready to hear argument from respondents.
May I please report, Mr. Roberts will present argument for respondents.
My name is Bruce Roberts. I represent the state of Misty Lindberg. I tried the case, and I'd like to set the record clear. Number one, this was her usual stop. There were two stops. The first stop, Misty was in the third grade. The first stop is if she was going directly to her mother's house. The second stop was her mother sometimes worked nights, so Misty would have to go to the second stop to go to the babysitter. This was a normal place for her to get off. It was not an unusual stop. It was not her normal stop. It was her normal stop. Number two, you have to understand the surroundings. There was only one house on the right side of the highway, Mr. Hinton's. There was no other house. So when she got off the bus, if she wasn't going to the Hinton house, there was nothing but pasture land. The bus driver had to know she was going to cross the street. That is clear in the record. There was no other place for her to go but across the street. That is undisputed. The last undisputed fact is the man who hit Misty said, if the bus had been there, if it had been stationary, I would have never driven through there, I would have never hit her. Had the bus remained stationary, this accident would never have happened. That's the bottom line. Now, first, as to whether or not it arose out of the operation and use, we contend he waived that argument. It was never raised. It was raised by special exception, but no hearing was had on it. No order was entered. It was only raised on motion for rehearing before the Court of Appeals. We contend he waived it. But number two, what is the function of a school bus but to get the children home safely? Part of that function is for it to remain stationary so the child can cross the street. It has flashing red lights to do that. This bus driver failed to use the bus properly in that he failed to maintain it stationary. He failed to keep it stopped. Now, they take the position that the bus was a half mile away. They take the position that the faster the bus flees the scene of the crime, it ought to escape liability. That makes no sense from a policy standpoint. We want to enforce safety, not excuse it, not say the faster you unload the children, the faster you drive away, the faster you escape liability. The function of a school bus is to get children home safely. To do that, the bus must remain stationary. It must activate those red flashers and must give that child time to cross the highway. The undisputed facts are there was one house on the right side of the highway. The rest of it was pasture land. No other houses, no other place for that child to be going. The undisputed facts established in the record were that child got off the school bus, walked 7 paces away from it, bent down to either tie her shoelace or pick a flower or do something. When she stood up, that bus was gone, and she was alone on a busy highway. She thereafter tried to cross that highway, and she was killed. Those are the undisputed facts.
What about the walking down in the ditch, being waved across by the woman driving behind the bus, and the child refusing to walk across at that time?
One lady testified she walked some 7 or 8 paces down away from the bus, obviously trying to walk behind the bus. One lady said she did wave the child on. There was traffic. The child apparently was waiting for the traffic to clear. One person did wave her on. That's true. And it's true perhaps this child in the third grade did not exercise the best care.
That's totally irrelevant, but we've got to, is it true the child is just 7 years old?
Yes.
She was in the third grade?
2 weeks into the third grade when this event happened.
Even that, a 7-year-old in the third grade. But there's no doubt the child was 7 years old.
Yeah, 7 and a half approximately.
What was the issue the judge submitted as to her conduct?
Ordinary care.
Well, they were put in there for a 7-and-a-half-year-old child.
I believe language that effect, yes, sir.
You had any problem with that issue?
No, sir. But granted, and I think that goes to the point of why you have bus remain stationary, is that third graders act like third graders. They don't keep the best lookout around. They do dart into traffic. But that's why you keep a bus stationary. That's why you have those red blinkers, because you say these are children, and they act like children, and we need to exercise a high degree of care to protect children.
What should the bus driver have done in this situation, in your view of the...
He should have remained stationary. Again, you need to understand...
Well, not forever.
The child walked 7 paces away. There's nothing but pasture out there. Now, there was issues submitted. That was another point before to the Court of Appeal. We tried to question the bus driver about his duty to inquire as to where the third grader was going. We think he failed to maintain stationary long enough to allow the child to cross. I think he had an obligation to see where this child was headed. Those are facts that we raised before the Court of Appeal that weren't addressed, but I think he failed to maintain it stationary long enough. He failed to ask where this child, where she was going.
How long is long enough?
I think, I can't put a time frame on it, but obviously if you have a child who is not crossing the street, the bus driver should inquire as to what the child is doing, or, you know, come on across the street.
Off the bus, get off the bus and say, where are you going, little girl?
No, not necessarily. She only walked 7 paces. I think he would be open the door and say, are you crossing the street? It's not unduly burdensome.
Opposing counsel said that the bus was some couple hundred yards away at the time of the accident.
That's correct.
I that doesn't indicate a very short time lapse.
I don't know what the speed of the bus is, but the testimony was three cars passed and then she attempted to cross the highway. I would estimate it was under, from that testimony, 30 seconds, 45. I don't think time frame is given.
Should the bus driver wait 30, 45 seconds to see if the child's going to cross?
I think if you have a situation where there's nothing but pasture where the child is, the bus driver should indicate
motion. Nobody disputes the fact that a bus driver ought to watch and see what the kids do. But we've got a real life situation here that involves what would a reasonable bus driver do under the same similar circumstances. And should he wait 30 seconds?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
See what a child, while the child ties a shoe, makes up the mind to go across the street?
The child, yes, sir. Yes, sir. I think...
And in the real world, is that going to work?
Yes, sir. I think there's no... There was no indication that the child was deliberately delaying or just sitting there. She's bent down either to tie her shoelace or whatever, and when she stood up, the bus was gone. She walked out from the bus and towards the rear.
Next question. Articulate for me your position that use of a motor vehicle was involved in this particular injury.
Yes, sir. The function of a school bus is to transport our children safely home. Part of that function, part of that use, the bus is used to remain stationary to allow the children to cross the street. It is used by using its red blinkers to warn traffic. That is the proper way to use a school bus. You don't simply just drop children off. You keep it in a stationary position, allow them time to cross the highway. The bus driver failed to use the bus properly in that he failed to manage station. Maintain it in a stationary position. He failed to leave the red blinker, the red flashers activated. He failed to use it in that manner.
Do you have cases of it? Of course, coming back is always a difficult thing, but do you have cases about a failure to use some item as causing an accident?
There is one appellate decision involving a school bus and under similar circumstance. It is in my brief. I do not know.
That's Hitchcock and Darwin?
I believe so, yes, sir. But look at the converse of it. And again, I'm not totally familiar with the Texas Tort Claims Act, but we have liability for using tangible objects or objects. What would be your position if an ambulance pulled up and says, well, if we use a real object, we're going to be liable, so let's just let him lay there and bleed? You have to impose standards and say, what is care? In the school bus situation, what he's arguing is that let's not stand here and be safe. Let's get away from the scene of the accident. If we're a half mile away, we're not liable. I don't think that's the proper way to look at this. What was the safe thing to do in the operation and use of a motor vehicle? The safe thing and a proper use was to maintain the bus stationary with its flashers activated. You shouldn't encourage or take the position, as the petitioner does, that the faster and the further we get away, the less our liability. I don't think that's a proper approach to this. I think the question is, had he remained stationary, would the accident have happened? No, it wouldn't have. Did he use it in a proper manner? No, he didn't. He left too early. He failed to maintain the bus in a stationary position as it was intended to, because it's got those flashers. It was intended to be used in that manner, clearly. That's why it has red flashers.
Do most children walk to the rear of the bus after they've exited the bus to cross?
Probably not. No, sir.
So, is there any school policy on whether a departing child should go to the front of the bus to cross the street or to the rear of the bus?
That was an issue in the lawsuit. We attempted to elicit testimony from the bus driver. It was not proper practice to ask the child where she was going. That was omitted, and again, if this thing goes back, that will be raised again. But I believe the bus driver testified in deposition that the proper practice was to inquire where the child was going. And he never did.
Does the bus driver have full visibility of the child, regardless of whether the child goes to the front or to the rear of the bus? Front or rear after departing the bus?
It has rear view mirrors. I think Mr. Gullion testified he didn't look. He did not see where she went. But he knew that she did not cross in front of the bus.
How did he know that she did not cross in front of the bus if he didn't look?
That was his testimony. He did not look, and it was undisputed that she didn't attempt to cross the front of the bus. Secondly, assuming this was in the operation use of a motor vehicle, the second question then is, what degree of care should we impose upon our school buses. And he says the Court of Appeals created a new duty. It did not. The legislature said we're going to hold, under the Texas Tort Claims Act, you liable for the operation and use of a motor vehicle. I think if you use that vehicle as an ordinary passenger car, you're liable using ordinary care. But when you begin to transport students for remuneration, and that's an important point, he talks about all these other situations. This bus driver was compensated just like a bus driver for Greyhound or a Delta Airlines pilot. He's compensated for transporting these children, just like any other common carrier. He's not a police officer. He's not an ambulance driver. He is paid.
Now, the child was not paying the school district for this transportation, was she?
You could argue that if you wanted to go that route, I think you could make an argument that through school taxes, but I don't think literally she was paying for it. No.
The distinction on common carriers, as I'm saying, is not that people work for a salary rather than volunteering their time, it's that they are charging the union.
That's correct. That's correct. What we contend is that there's no difference. An escalator and an elevator are considered common carriers. Why should people riding an escalator or an elevator, why should the operator of a mall escalator owe a higher degree of care than we require from a school bus driver to its children? There's no distinction.
Is a church bus a common carrier?
Excuse me?
Is a church bus a common carrier?
Your Honor, I take the position that if you transport people, and again, there's going to be facts, but if you transport people for remuneration, as the school district did, and with a paid driver, I think you owe those people a high degree of care. There's no distinction, as far as a policy reason, between escalators, elevators, or anybody on a bus being transported. The same reason that you impose that high degree of care is that they are totally helpless. They are relying upon you to transport them from one point to another safely. And courts, every time they face that, they started out with the old buses, and the airplanes, escalators, elevators. When you transport somebody who is totally dependent upon you, then you owe them a high degree of care. I see no distinction between a church bus being transporting somebody with a paid bus driver than a Greyhound.
Why is the paid bus driver important?
Well,
if you
I think
a volunteer church bus driver, it's the same. You put
right.
yourself in there.
Trying to distinguish between, say, a police officer driving around or this somebody just has somebody in as a passenger in a car. That obviously is not a common carrier or high degree situation.
Why not? I mean, you put yourself in there anyway.
I think because, again, going to the remuneration factor, that there is some pay there. They are being paid. There has to be a dividing line somewhere. I think that's a fair dividing line.
What would the policy reason be behind the creation of the doctrine of high degree of care?
I think it's the same policy reason that goes back to Greyhound or escalators or elevators. You're placing, in this case especially, small children into the hands of a professional driver, and we ought to require him to exercise high degree of care. As he stated, there are no regulations or rules telling the bus driver he should remain stationary. That's, to me, you want to place upon him a high degree of care in that situation. If we
didn't
require
that doctrine arise perhaps as a way around the harshness of contributory negligence?
Your Honor, I'll be honest. In reading the cases, that maybe more recent cases, that was not discussed.
No, I'm talking about when this whole doctrine came up.
That could be correct, Your Honor. I'll be honest. I was reading more recent cases, and it was simply discussing the inequities of the passenger versus the operator. And that's why we should place a high degree of care on the operator. Finally,
it has nothing to do with caring people for pay, for hire.
That was, again, a factor in the cases. The cases would vary. Remuneration for the driver was one factor. The fact that the passenger had to depend upon the driver for care was another factor. There were several factors, and it varied really from case to case. But the primary one that seemed to run through all the cases was the fact that the passenger had to rely upon the driver, was in his or her hands. The final point that, again, I think ties in everything is this final point that she safely alighted from the school bus. So even if we owe a high degree of care, she safely alighted and was on the ground. And I think that, again, just ties back to the whole situation. He says, well, she was reasonably safe where she was. You have to understand, this was a third grade child on a busy highway alone and unprotected. Anybody passing that child there on this highway, I don't think anybody would say she's in a reasonably safe place. That is not a reasonably safe place for a third grade child to be. The school district recognizes this because they're supposed to, or at least it's customary, to keep the school bus stationary. Again, it all ties back. He says, well, we're not liable because we left. Then we're not liable because it was a safe place. But that's not correct. The point is, you don't leave third grade children on a highway alone and unprotected when it's clear that they have no place to go but across the highway. There are no other homes, no other places for that child to go but across the highway. And that's exactly what she attempted, and because of that, she was killed. Had the bus remained stationary, the event would never have occurred. He states that the court wanted to create a new affirmative duty to anticipate the behavior of children. I don't believe that's what the Court of Appeals intended or stated. What it said simply was, in using ordinary care, when you've got small children, using ordinary care, you have to anticipate some misconduct. With a high degree of care, you have a greater duty to anticipate. It didn't place any new affirmative duties on the school bus.
Do you have cases that say that that established cases on the duties of the common carrier extend to watching for someone after they leave? There is a case up in Massachusetts about letting the drunk off the subway.
Vaguely familiar with that case. I do have cases that say that you have to, your liability ends when you leave them in a reasonably safe place. But if you don't leave them in a reasonably safe place, your liability does not end. Now, in that regard, I had 2 points. Number one, I don't think as a matter of law you could say that that was a reasonably safe place. But number two, I think it is, and that, again, I think it would be an issue for the jury in the instruction. But number two, I think it was obviously a very unsafe place, and the law is very clear that when a common carrier drops somebody off at an unsafe place, its liability extends until that person reaches a safe place. In this situation, this bus dropped a third grade child off on a busy highway, no houses, where she obviously had to cross the highway. And she crossed that highway and was killed. I think it was clearly an unsafe place to leave that child. And I think it's clear that the school district knows that because they normally require the school bus to remain stationary. Again, I think this goes to common sense. If you're driving down a highway, you see a third grade child, small child, standing beside a busy highway alone, anybody's going to say that's not a safe place for that child to be. So I don't think they can say, well, she safely alighted from the bus, therefore our liability ends. They're acting as if, unless she trips down the stairs, they have no liability. Clearly, they have an obligation to make sure that that child is left in a reasonably safe place. I think clearly they failed to do that. Again, as far as opening the box, the Tort Claims Act goes to operation and use of motor vehicles. I don't think the Court of Appeals was creating any new law. It was simply saying, when you use a motor vehicle as a passenger vehicle, then you have ordinary care. When you use a motor vehicle as a common carrier in a common carrier situation, you owe a high degree of care. That's not new law. It's not creating new law. It's defining what the legislature intended. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Well, some of us on the court are not reading every case cited in all the briefs. It's just special for this week, isn't it? What's this Hitchcock versus Garland, Brad?
I'm glad you asked. That's a summary judgment case where there was no question but the school bus driver didn't turn on the lights. The child was struck in attempting to cross the street because the cars behind and the front did not stop because the lights weren't active.
So you think that's a whole lot different from not waiting and putting on blinking lights?
Yes, sir. I don't see a problem in imposing a duty of ordinary care on the bus driver. All it did was reverse the summary judgment and send it back to the trial court saying that there was at least an issue of fact as to whether or not that was used.
Well, is it anywhere in this record about what the school district's policy was on the use of blinking lights?
The policy of the school district or the policy of Mr. Gilliland? Mr. Gilliam,
Mr.
Gilliam testified as to what he customarily did.
And that's all we have.
Yes, sir. So I think Hitchcock's case is kind of is distinguishable. The one case that they have cited for this, you have to deposit them in a reasonably safe place, is McQuaid, Houston Transit versus McQuaid case, which is a situation where a lady had caught a public bus that was a contract situation with a private carrier. She was let off at an intersection intending to cross over to another intersection. She was injured in that situation. I think that that is clearly distinguishable because of the same basis that the cases cited from out of state by the Court of Appeals are distinguishable. It's a private carrier. There is no question that it's a common carrier and the law should apply. She was injured, and I don't remember the specific facts I was trying to say, but she was injured after she had actually gotten off. I think it was something about her tripping over a curb because of the lighting, but I'm not positive about that.
Under the identical facts of this case, could have been a private bus company?
I don't
taking Greyhound that this little girl had fulfilled?
If she'd been taking Greyhound bus, they would not be liable. The law in this state does not extend the duty to common carrier once she is safely alighted. And I disagree.
You think
this is safe? Go ahead.
Is that a fact issue or a matter of law about safety or liability?
I think it's a fact issue that should have been submitted to the jury, and it was waived by them not submitting. I think there's a question here of Rule 279 of a deemed finding by the court, because that would, a finding that it, that she was deposited or let off at a safe place, clearly constitutes part of the court's judgment here. And it was never requested, an issue was never requested, it was never objected to, and under Rule 279, I think it's a deemed finding. So I disagree with the Court of Appeals who says that's a fact question. In this situation, it's not. The problem that you have here is a question that the respondent wants you to think about is, well, gosh, because there was an accident, it was obviously unsafe. They seem to infer that this duty applies until the child reaches home. Had she crossed the street and been walking down the other side and decided to come back across the street and was struck, does the duty extend that far? If you use their logic that if the bus had been there with the lights blinking, the accident wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't happen in the situation I just gave you. But do we extend the duty that far? How long does the bus have to sit there before it can assure itself to move on? The evidence in this case was that the young lady stepped off the bus. She walked 6 to 8 paces, bent over, appeared to tie her shoe, stood up, continued to walk. She was waved across by the lady in the car behind the bus. She shook her head and continued to walk down the side of the road. The bus left. Three cars that were behind the bus pulled off, and evidence is that they were 150 to 200 yards down the road. So we're not talking about a situation where he pushes her out the door and drives off. We're talking about a situation where a significant period of time had elapsed from her getting off the bus until all of the cars and situations moved off. And
let me ask you this, Mr. Mercer. Excuse me for a minute.
Sure.
This is a hypothetical. Let us assume that the court said that there is a high degree of care imposed upon a school bus driver. Would it be a question of fact for the jury if the argument was made, for example, that under a high degree of care, the bus driver had the burden not only to stop the bus and put on the warning lights, but to get off the bus and escort the child across the street. Is that a jury question, or would that be a question for the court?
As to whether or not they did that?
No, as to whether or not, as to whether or not that would constitute failure of exercise of high degree of care.
I think it's a question for the jury with a proper instruction by the judge. I think that you still have to submit that. There are a couple of things that respondent raised that I'd like to address if I could. One is the discussion with regard to escalator and elevator cases. It's interesting to note in the cases that they've cited in that regard, the duty ends when you get off the elevator or get off the escalator.
And I can't, in my mind, rationalize the extension of those other than to say that those are situations involving private operators. Those were not public buildings. Those were private operators of escalators, of an escalator, and private operator of an elevator. So I think you're back to a situation where they're talking about reliance on the other party. Now, with regard to this question of remuneration, in their response to our application, I think the respondents are correct. It says that the Texas courts have realized that the carrier, and this is talking about common carriers, duty of care is not dependent upon the compensation paid. So whether it's a school bus driver who gets paid, it's a church bus driver who volunteers, that's not the question involved in the situation. So I don't think that that's a consideration for this court. They raised in their response also the argument that the question of waiver of immunity under the Tort Claims Act was waived at the trial court and not properly before this court. Bob Weber from my office tried this case. He filed special exceptions. He filed an answer with an affirmative defense. There's a ruling on the special exceptions, which is in the supplemental transcript. It was raised at the trial court level, and I direct the court's attention to page 185 in the Statement of Facts. In a discussion there, he moved for dismissal on that basis, and it was overruled by the court. It was raised in his brief, it was raised in his motion for rehearing, and we've raised it here. So I think that there's no question it's properly been preserved for this court. Otherwise, I don't know how to preserve it. So I think that question is here, and it's the basic question of this whole lawsuit. And I think that the court has to address that first before you get into the other issues. Now, as far as an obligation or an affirmative duty to make sure that the child has gone someplace, gone home or whatever, I don't think that that's the law under the Tort Claims Act, because that's not use at that point in time. It's not use or operation of a motor vehicle. What has happened in this situation is very simply, like I said in the beginning, the Court of Appeals has taken a case where there shouldn't be a liability under the Tort Claims Act. In fact, it's forbidden. Imposed liability or imposed a standard creating liability in a case where it doesn't even apply to the facts of the case. Therefore, I think that the question is a question of law for this court to decide, to reverse the Court of Appeals, find that the standard is ordinary care, like the majority of the jurisdictions who've addressed this, and to then reverse their opinion and render. Any questions? Thank you.
Court will take another brief recess.
Lawyers will please rise.
Thank you.